People who are chronically late. So I was thinking about why they're chronically late. So one reason could be for the drama. You know, they make a statement when they enter and everybody notices them. That's one possibility. Then there's another possibility that, and believe it or not, this is actually a possibility, is just people who feel a lot of guilt in general, and by coming late, they get to apologize. But then forget all the psychology. Thank you so much. Forgetting, I think so. I know, that's Bill. Thank you. Forgetting all the psychology could really be a problem with executive functioning, which is the capacity to organize, which includes coming on time. So, you know, it's fun to look for the psychological reasons, but sometimes it's just that someone has trouble with executive functioning. They could be very well-meaning. They mean to come on time, and they think they have just enough time to get there, but they don't. But they can't balance that. You see this a lot with students. We have one student who's brilliant. She's 13 years old. They ask her a question in nuclear physics, she'll answer it. But she can't get from classroom A to classroom B. And we've asked the teachers, please do not dock her. She really cannot do it on her own.
There's the other aspect of that. The person is habitually early. Is there 20 minutes before everybody else? Comes to your house 20 minutes before you.
Yes, and you're never, and you're not ready, right?
Would you say that's two sides of the same coin?
It's definitely not an executive functioning thing.
It's not?
Mm-mm. No. Because they're managing to get there early. Need some more back to, can I ask you to pass
that? That could be the perfectionism thing.
That could be a little perfectionistic, OCD. Or they just want to be there first. I don't know.
Here's an extra one.
Oh, thank you. So that's what I came up with for executive functioning. So tonight, we're going to decide ourselves how to resolve some dilemmas. The dilemmas I put out here are just some examples. I'm hoping that you will have some of your own hypothetical or real ones, and there's no special order, and yours come first. But let's just review a couple of things. V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. That's the basic foundation of the whole Torah. So if we accept and love ourselves, it's a lot easier to accept and love other people. Chesed is the key. From what we get, we make a living. What we give makes a life. Then I have something that I'm calling Rachel's guidelines. Rachel Minko V'Lea Shalom. This is based on some things that Judy was kind enough to share with me. And you tell me if you agree with this, Judy. But what I took out from Rachel's life, some pieces, was maintain a positive attitude. Enough said about that. Accept all others and treat them kindly and with respect. Judy shared with me a video that Rachel had made. And what struck me was, here was someone struggling with her illness, and she spent so much time talking about how wonderful her parents are, how she feels so bad for them, that this is so painful for them, and how wonderful the community is. I think that's pretty incredible. So accept all others and treat them kindly and with respect. I think we could safely say that's one of her rules. And appreciate each and every day as a special gift, which it really is. I'm going to put in a bid for the rabbi. Not in terms of, you know, some people hesitate to ask the rabbi. They don't want someone else telling them what to do. But the rabbi, especially anyone who belongs here, you've got it made. I don't think he sees his job as telling anyone what to do so much as giving some guidance. Think about it this way. Think about it that way. Sometimes with dilemmas, we just want to hear somebody say, somebody to tell us, if you do it this way, it will be all right. If you do it that way, it will be all right. You have to decide. But a rabbi, a rav, can be a tremendous asset when we're facing a dilemma. And we also have our recognition that a rabbi is what we call Das Torah. He represents Torah. So the direction and guidance and the input that he gives us, we can take as Torah, because it's based on his knowledge, his experience, his wisdom, and probably his own life and his approach. So use your rabbi as a resource, even if you don't speak to him all the time. But when there's a dilemma, it's nice to have somebody to touch base with. In my own life, I have found it very, very helpful. And again, not you must do it this way or you must do it that way, but would it be all right if I, whatever. So anybody here have some kind of dilemma that you wanted? And my goal here is, based on everything we learned about relationships, how would we go about resolving a dilemma? What would the factors be? I don't have the answers, and I'm not sure there's only one answer. Certainly not for the ones I presented. So, I'm so happy to hear from you.
I will share a very personal dilemma that I had some years ago. I was beside myself because I realized before anybody else in the family that my grandson, the first grandson, was autistic. And I came to the rabbi and I said, why, what is happening? And he said, Selma, sometimes when a child is born, his neshama comes from back from Olam Haba, and it has a limited job to do here on Earth. And he doesn't have to be perfect to complete what he has to do here. And maybe if you look at it that way, did it solve my problem completely?
No, he can't solve it.
No, he can't. But he gave me a way to take comfort.
And a way to look at the situation.
Yeah.
Thank you.
He was
helpful.
And that was early on in his...
I thought you would tell me that your dilemma was, should you say anything or should you keep quiet?
No, I haven't.
That's what I thought your dilemma would be.
The dilemma was that I did say something and it caused a great deal of problem because the doctor said, she's overreacting. But in fact, clearly, 9 years later.
Yeah. Ooh.
That's a toughie.
Yes. Anybody, would you have handled it differently in the same way? Not as a critique, just what are the options? Many times parents are not ready to hear that there's something wrong.
And my child, to this day, can't take help from me, although I am a speech and language pathologist, because anything that I say, she considers judgmental. Mm-hmm. So it has created a chasm.
Oui.
Yeah. That's a dilemma.
Yeah. Unless you accept the fact that you cannot share your professional knowledge and just share your grandmotherly love.
She says, Mom, I need space, and I have to accept that.
Right.
So when you asked at the first session, does anybody here remember what they were even worried about last year?
You remember. Everybody's undermining me. Anybody else have a dilemma in your own life or a theoretical dilemma? Otherwise, you're going to be stuck with mine.
I didn't have a dilemma, but here's what I usually do if I'm faced with an issue and I can't make a decision. I take a piece of paper and I write on one side, what are the pluses and what are the minuses? And then I kind of put it away, or I stick it on my refrigerator. And then I look at it, and then as things turn out, however they turn out, I say, yeah, that's what I really wanted.
So I was looking at, I was at my sister, and she has a book called Baby Blues. I don't know if anyone ever heard of that, but it's cartoons about parents. And this is a new set of parents. The amazing thing is it's written by two men. They're cartoons by two men, and I don't know how they got into women's heads, but they really did. So the new parents were trying to decide about using disposable diapers versus cloth diapers. And they decided to do what you do, Rena, and just write down all the reasons. So they had about 15 reasons to use cloth diapers, the environment and softer on baby skin, and you have to think about landfills. And they looked at those reasons, and the other reason was very convenient. And they went for that. So sometimes there's logic, and then there's what we feel inside. All right, let's take a look at these dilemmas. One I think I read somewhere, and the others I just made up. But I think they're all kind of real-life things. So Sarah and Josh get engaged. They are planning to make Aliyah. Her parents buy them an apartment. Everybody's happy. Then the parents come once in a while. They stay a week. The next year, they stay 2 weeks. And it builds up until they're staying, let's say, over Pesach for a whole month. And Sarah sees that her husband is feeling a little bit pushed out of his space. What are some options? You do see the dilemma, right? Even if they weren't the ones who bought the apartment, let's even set that aside for a moment, but she's caught between honoring her parents and honoring her husband. Not simple. Now, the Talmud does talk about priorities in relationship, and spouse is always first. Spouse, children, parents, and then from there, neighbors, local friends, or, you know, more long-distance friends. But this is not a simple one. And I'll tell you what, this is the one I read somewhere, and I'll tell you what the person did. So she's caught between a rock and a hard place, basically.
And this is very common. Like, I actually had this, you know, like when Yontif came in, a number of my kids wanted to come with their families, and I just realized that I could not have everybody at the same time. I couldn't have all the babies, and, you know, that. And I actually, you know, very nicely, I had to tell them that we have to divide things up. I just can't do it. I mean, I was very honest with them. I said, love you, it's not that. And I knew they had a place to go. You know, they had the other side to go to. So.
But what if your husband said, I want all of them here?
He did say that, but I said, I can't. He did, because he loves having everybody together. Like, that is absolutely his highlight, you know? But I said, I can't do it.
Okay, but here,
I guess a little different.
This, I think this is actually a little tougher. You have to have enough strength inside you to recognize this is too much, and it won't be good for me, and if it's not good for me, it won't be good for anybody. So you had to have that, which I am not minimizing at all. I'm quite impressed that you were able to say it. In this case, she has to almost choose between her husband and her parents. What are her options?
Possibility that perhaps someone could rent space in another apartment for them.
Is that what you were planning to say? Okay, picture her telling them she's renting space in another apartment. It could be worth it.
Figure out which of the two parents she can have the most straight conversation without hurting the feelings, mm-hmm. mother or the father, and explain the situation, and then come up with, you know, but I want you here, we have space in another apartment, and so forth.
So the children should rent the space?
Yeah. But I think there are two issues. One is that the family stays with them, or the family stays someplace else but eats with them.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can balance it out that way, then it's not so terrible. Maybe you can tell them they're going to have much more pleasant surroundings than if they were all cramped in our little apartment.
Relatives, yeah. If they have relatives there, that would be best.
Yeah.
But these ladies are recommending even going so far as to rent a place.
Or find people who are gone for some period of time and they can have.
They charge. In Israel, they charge.
They charge.
Especially in Jerusalem. That's how they pay their rent.
Yeah. Is this, when they got engaged and they planned to make Aliyah, her parents bought them an apartment. Now, because the parents bought them an apartment, is it possible in her father and maybe mother's mind, well, does it then... in a way, not consciously, but maybe somewhere in the father's mind, said, well, I bought this.
It's our place. It's our place.
It's
definitely possible. And it seems to me that would be a factor in how careful she would have to be in making a proposition for them to go elsewhere.
I also think on how it's said to the family.
So I was also wondering, and I'm running this by you because I really don't know, but I'll close the door. Second. Tell me if you think this is a possibility. She recognizes that her husband feels his space is being encroached upon. What if she made sure that the two of them got out? You know, that they took a walk every day or they had a couple meals to themselves, mm-hmm. and she sent the parents out for a meal. Would that be an option? And maybe it would be less painful than having her say to her parents, you need to get out. You know, you can say it as nicely as you want, but basically the message is, I need you out of here.
You also, on here, you said that Sarah saw that her husband felt his space was being invaded, so it's her perception, too. She hasn't really asked him.
Well, let's assume that
he's
made it quite clear that his space is being invaded. Yeah. Yeah, I just put it nicely.
Well, I think part of the question is also, how long do we think they really are going to stay for? Because your solution might work for a short period, but if they're staying for a year, I mean...
No, a month. We're figuring a month.
Yeah,
a month is a... But a month can be a long time in a small apartment, and if someone feels he's missing his space or he feels a little inhibited, you know, he comes home and there they are.
And the other question is to say no, that they'll be leaving after a month. I think sort of the uncertainty is another issue, that he sees this as just an ongoing thing.
That's a good point.
He can be more irritable about it, and the taking space isn't going to work as well.
So the month, he could be afraid that the month would become 5 weeks.
Right, and that's where I think maybe it's important to have an open discussion with the parents, that not necessarily we want you to leave, but we just need to know when you're leaving so that we can make appropriate plans for how to work out the space.
How about being proactive mm-hmm. in this situation and saying to the bride says to her husband, look, naturally, if my parents are going to buy us this apartment, we have to understand that they will want to come and be with us. So, you know, how shall we arrange this? You know, to make a plan with him as to how we can handle this.
My guess is... you're not going to find too many brides and grooms that are even going to think along those lines.
True.
You know?
True.
This is going to happen, and then they have to come to grips
deal
with
it.
Yeah. And remember, it's slow growing. You come for a week, okay, big deal. We can handle it for a week. Even if you don't love your in-laws, you can live with it for a week, right? You can live with having them. 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, it's a different story. And by the time they get up to a month, there could be a child or two in the household.
Which would make it more desirable for the parents to want to stay longer, to be with the Aina Club.
Could be.
Yeah.
Or they might want some quiet.
Yeah, that's what I like.
I don't know.
Maybe it's a good time to suggest touring. It's like a few days in a lot.
You need a vacation.
Yeah.
I think it also,
as long as you're here, you should take advantage.
I think one consideration is when the parents do visit, if there were children, let's say,
mm-hmm.
how are they helpful? How are the parents when they visit? Is there more...
Do they expect to be served?
Is it a critiquing kind of situation, or is it a very open, what can we do to help? We'll babysit while you go out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the husband and wife are able to spend more time together.
So if we could give these two couples the characteristics we want to, it'd be fine.
Right.
There might be no dilemma. Yes, and that's a huge factor. He might feel, he could just be insecure and feels that they're looking down on him, even if they're not. You know, the husband.
Well,
who knows?
Well, maybe
you're right.
You know, we don't know if he's being certain comments may have been
mm-hmm.
misinterpreted, that they're not pleased with him in some way.
Right. Right. Anyone else have anything to say about Sarah and Josh and their dilemma? We've settled it for them. They're going to rent an apartment for her parents. Okay, yeah, so they could. I like that idea. How about number two? So you got Sam and Allison. They're really good friends with Lou and Pam. And then Lou and Pam decide to get a divorce. And Pam just doesn't want them to have anything to do with her ex. And this is also, this happens too frequently.
Yeah,
I lost some. Oh, boy. And you get stuck right in the middle.
Oh, absolutely. I lost all my friends after the divorce. I have one friend left. I mean, you know, I've been divorced now for years and years. But all my circle of friends were gone.
Because they felt put in the middle?
Well, yeah, they felt that. And my ex had a status. And it was kind of... better to
side with him, so to speak.
Yeah. So.
I saw a few heads nod.
Yeah, I'm just seeing them. Yeah, I'm thinking of a few friends I've had, particularly, you know, a couple of them were dating and then broke up, and we were told, I mean, don't have anything to do with the guy because he's no good. And you know, years later, thank God they all, everyone got married, everyone was friends. But at the time, it's
we can't hear you clearly here.
Oh, sorry, I'm just trying
said
to
it can be an awkward position. Who should she, who do we side with?
Yeah. But why does he have to side with anybody?
That's the question is, why do we have to side with anybody? Well, this is your good friend telling you you side with him. Now side doesn't even mean side with him. What she's saying is don't have him for a dinner. Don't invite him to your special occasions. I don't want to see him at your son's bar mitzvah.
Well, it also depends on, well, I mean, I'm kind of thinking of the situation that we had where my husband and I, well, my husband had a very good childhood friend who got married, and, you know, they were very close for years and years. And,
with the two of you?
Yeah. And then I became a little close with the wife just, for, you know, through my husband, through, you know, his friend. And they ended up getting divorced. And it was very awkward because it was a bad divorce.
Right.
So even though the wife, I got along well with the wife, but I felt very uncomfortable just maintaining the relationship with her because there was no way, especially when she was still going through the trauma of the divorce, that her ex was not going to come up in the conversation. And, you know, her ex was my husband's good friend from childhood. So it was kind of lost touch. I couldn't see any way to resolve that.
Okay, so what are you going to tell Allison, Sam and Allison? Not to invite Lou? Do I have the names right? Yeah.
I don't know whether it really means nothing to do. I mean, it depends on what you mean by nothing to do.
Nothing to do.
Because
I think that happens very often. If you're having him, I can't talk to you anymore. It's like an ultimatum. I I do hear that. I mean, that happens. Well,
time.
You're left with the choice. Time is fine, but you're making a 50th birthday party for somebody, for a mutual friend. And their mutual friend, the two of them. What do? Cut one out?
I don't think you should cut anybody out. I think you can invite the person and it's up to that person to do that. Remember, I've been in that position. I've gone through this divorce and it's now 10 years later. My matron in honor and my best man were married to each other. Childhood friend, as far as my husband, my ex, and the best man. Let's all be friends. Wonderful. I can pick up the phone and talk with her. She's on my Facebook. Would she reach out to me as far as the wife? Because we became very good friends. She was the only female in my wedding party. And the rest were all guys. And to this day, she does not. But the family reaches out to me. You know, we have a cousin in Owings Mills. You know,
Ex's family?
My ex's family. My mother-in-law wants me to come for Thanksgiving. I just couldn't do it. You know, because to me it was Thanksgiving being everybody meeting the kids, my ex, and then as he had into girlfriend, I just couldn't do it. So thanks.
But he clearly never gave the word that it's you or him.
Correct.
So
that's what we also, I never did it to anybody of our friends either.
I wish that were typical. It should be.
Yeah.
It should be. But what, you are Allison. What are you doing? Or you're Sam and Allison. Little schizophrenia there, but okay. What are you doing?
Sometimes you need to take a step back and recognize that there's a certain level of anger and immaturity too, that, you know, if this person doesn't want to be your friend anymore because you're associating with someone going through a divorce, and just, it is a matter of time and it's a choice, and it's unfortunate that, you know, nobody can dictate who you, I mean, I've had this too, where especially when Rachel was sick, people who were divorced would come, you know, to visit us or whatever, and or be very friendly, and I knew that there were certain friends of ours who weren't speaking to them, and it was awkward, but, you know, we can't dwell on those things and just...
So you're saying, tell me if I'm right, just keep living your life, and maybe you have to tell Pam, listen, you need some time. We want to maintain our friendship with both of you. Is that?
Yeah.
Yeah? You may get, you know, you might get cut out. But I think you'll feel like you did the right thing. And you have to be ready for those consequences. All right, so we solved their problem? No, but you see... it's hard. We have the goal of maintaining some kind of peace and connection. And sometimes whatever we do, somebody will end up feeling not connected or not at peace. And maybe at that point, what we need to say is, I have to be at peace with myself, that I'm doing something honorable and I'm doing the best I can. We cannot take responsibility for somebody else's response.
I just have a different feeling about this. I feel that if I have some problem with one of the pair, that I feel that they did not act honorably, or that would then my discretion would be, look, I'm sorry, but I cannot continue our friendship. I cannot tolerate somebody saying, you may not see him anymore or her. I can't take that.
So you're distinguishing between
personal.
If I myself have an issue that I think somebody did something wrong here, that's different from somebody trying to tell me whom I can befriend.
We're adults here.
Supposedly. Right. It's not simple to act like an adult. That's the other thing that became clear to me thinking about dilemmas. You know, kind of almost easier to act like a child, but that's our responsibility, to act like an adult, even though we may not always feel like an adult. And it takes a little bit of a push, and that push really is a is a growth for us. Anytime we act like an adult when we don't want to, or we reach out when we don't really feel like it, or we tolerate certain things for the sake of a relationship, we grow. And I think anytime we decide we will not tolerate certain things, such as in this case, if Pam decides to cut us out, so be it. That's her choice. Okay. I really thought you folks would have a bunch of your own. Let's take a look at the Cones and the Millers. Good friends, good neighbors, 10 years. And then the Miller's son is getting bullied by their son.
I would like to find out how old these children are. First thing. Second thing is...
Why would that make a difference? You're saying, let's find out how old the children are.
Because with the younger child, it's much easier to deal with it with the family. And also, because I deal with children, is to have the parents talk about it without the children around. Just describe the problem without analyzing it.
Okay, let me throw another piece in there. You're the Millers, and you know that about a year ago, another neighbor made a comment to the Cones, very gently letting them know that one of their children was doing something wrong. And that was it. So you know that if you say something, it's over. There, I've made that complicated a little bit.
What's over?
The relationship. The good neighbor policy.
Well, if the parents want to really help the child, then they have to deal with it. Unless there's some intermediary. Somebody who's not, a school counselor or a rabbi who's not involved with these right now.
Okay, so one option is have somebody else approach the parents of the bully. What about approaching the bullying child himself?
That's why it says you have to know how old the children.
So old enough, let's say 10. Because I agree with you, when it's a little child, you can step in much more easily.
So the parents of the boy who has been hurt approaching the child
who's doing the hurting. You're just as you're in the same spot as if you had told them yourself, and maybe worse. Why'd you scream? You traumatized our child, and
you're blaming him for something he didn't do.
Right.
There was just a play, and
sorry, one second. You want to?
I just want to say that.
And we'll get to the play.
When I ever had an issue with a child, like a grandparent died. So I would take a book and I would read it just to that child. Because sometimes I found that if I read it to the child, they would begin to say something or draw about it or whatever it was. And that's why I'm asking them how old this child is. But if I knew how old the child was, I would find some kind of vehicle to describe the situation as if it's somebody else and ask them what to do with it.
That's an interesting thought. You got that? Describe it to the bully, read a book to the bully, or tell him a story. What do you think?
But your feelings are pretty intense at that point. You're protecting your child. Your child's been hurt. You know, the first thing that comes to your mind might not be to read to the kid.
Yes, right. At a minimum. Yeah. And you said you saw a play?
There was just a play downtown. Exactly, this was the situation. One child hit another child, and the parents, and broke his tooth. And the parents...
Broke his tooth?
Yeah. The parents of the injured child came to see the other parents and said, look, I think your son really needs to apologize. And they said, he really was taunting him. You know, they both became defensive, and what seemed like a very civilized meeting with tea being served and so on, soon became a balagan. they were at each other's throats. I mean, really, in full force. So you have to be very, very careful. Both parents are very vested in their own children.
Right.
And
right.
You have to be so, so very careful.
I still think somebody here said that child has to be protected. We're talking serious bullying, not not the little stuff.
No.
So the first obligation of the parents is to their own child.
Right.
So here's my question. They're neighbors. So let's say to protect the child, they talk to the other parents. But every time their child goes outside, he's still seeing the other one, and they're still seeing each other. Is there any other option? I don't know.
I still think the third party.
I like the third party idea.
Is the one who
I mean, if they're going to the same school, if they're in the same class, then perhaps the teacher can be advised of this so that at least in school there's no attacking. And let's face it, that first child is really at risk if he's going to go on with these behaviors.
The bully or the
yeah,
one
the
who's...
Bully. Oh, the bully is really at risk. He's going to get himself into more and more trouble if he is not...
Well, the child who's being bullied is also at
well,
risk because that can last a lifetime, the effects of being bullied.
It brings to mind something that happened years ago with my own son in fifth grade, where it was very... It was popular groups, you know how sometimes there's a group.
The in group.
The in group. And my son was not in the in group, but a neighbor of ours, in that they lived in the development and we weren't close friends, but certainly knew each other, knew who we were. So one day my son came home and I noticed a little redness on his face. Well, he started to cry. He had been beaten up at recess, and the teachers were three. It was a team of three teachers, and they were on the other side of the playground, as teachers will do. They forget to supervise sometimes. And he'd been beaten up because they were outside with a ball playing soccer. And my son, it was muddy, it had been raining, and he threw the ball, and the kids, evidently some mud got on this young man's pants. And he was a very popular young man, and I'm sure a straight A student. And he was the oldest in his family. So he used foul language and about the pants, look what you did to my pants. My son winds up on the ground. And the interesting thing was everybody, and he was pummeled, but he was wearing
not just by this boy, but by his friends?
By one boy.
Just by one boy.
By one boy. But nobody stopped this one boy who was out there. My son did have a friend who waited, but what was interesting, the teachers blew the whistle, the kids go in, they didn't notice that he was not going, that he had not gone in, and, you know, I'm going into detail, but he went into the school with a friend, went to the bathroom, and went right to the nurse, and so the nurse happened to call me and said, oh, he just had a little, he came in and he has some redness on his face and downplayed it a lot. When I got the true story from my son, and I told my husband, I contacted the teacher immediately and she didn't have a clue. Then evidently the boy must have told his mother, I get a call from his mother that...
Is she the one in the same development as you?
Yes. And I don't know if it was that night or the next day. The next day, after my husband and I got all the details written down, my husband went to school, saw exactly where the fight was and where the teachers were, went inside, talked to the teacher, and said that he didn't do his homework. This is what my son says has happened. The language, whatever, whatever. And this child could be a witness, blah, blah, blah. And just said, don't give him a zero for not doing his homework. And then my son contacted my husband went to the principal and said, I'd like to set up a meeting. And it was that night that the parent, who is also a Baltimore County employee, she's a speech pathologist in Baltimore County, called me and invited my son to their house for the weekend. And, you know, Matt, now, that is probably where I made my mistake. In retrospect, looking back, I should have said, thank you, and can I call you back? And then thought about that and talked to my son about that, my husband.
That's what I call the big stall, by the way. When you need some thinking time or you're so aggravated, you say, let me get back to you.
Right, but I was 20 years, almost 20 years younger, and I wasn't really sure. So, and I have to tell you, I was angry. I was.
Sure.
I took him to the dentist, and he had to have the braces. It was, and there, just the attitude of some of those in-group kids. So I did not go to the meeting.
So you were feeling more than the bullying. You were feeling the whole, your son's whole situation.
I'm his mother.
Yeah, I'm just summing up.
In retrospect, I would have accepted her invitation because
you would.
Yes, I would have tried to have my son and her son become friends, or to at least have some time cordially together. Because I went, I didn't go to the meeting, and she said the mother had said to me she knew the meeting. She said, I guess I'll see you tomorrow morning, because the meeting was scheduled first thing. I said, well, I won't be coming. My husband will be there. And then she made a comment and that Matt didn't do anything but push him. You know, I shouldn't even say the names. But I said, well, that's not true. My son has witnesses. And she said, well, my son has witnesses, too. The end. At the meeting, which I did not go to, again, the mother stated, you know, that she didn't believe what the language,
what your son was saying,
the language and that the actions of her son. And the teacher at that point said, we've talked to a lot of the kids, and what these are the true facts. So how it was resolved personally at that time, I was so angry, and I was teaching myself in a public school, that I wanted him suspended, because I think if you fight like that,
mm-hmm.
I wanted them to, but that was wrong too. In retrospect, it wouldn't have done any good. So they put him on what you call a 504 for working 4 sessions with the school psychologist on anger management. There was, but that, you know what, the end result was,
you do the anger management.
But the bottom line was, because of the how do you call it, the social climate of the parent climate, the PTA climate,
mm-hmm.
And whose parents are popular with who, and many of the children turned against my son.
Oh,
you
boy.
Know, I never really could.
So
it even got worse in middle school.
So let me ask you, what do you think of the idea that the mother of the child who beat up,
and even some of her friends, the mother's friends, sort of
turned against you.
In a way, yeah.
So what do you think about that offer to have beaten up child stay over for a weekend?
No, not a weekend.
Not a weekend?
A play date.
A play date. Okay, a play date.
How old is the child?
5th grade.
That's 10. What do you think, expert?
I mean, I don't think I would want my child going over there. and being supervised by a parent who's defending her son that he didn't really do anything wrong. Yeah.
So what would, looking back,
yeah,
what could she have done?
Her motive for calling me was to sweep it under the carpet.
Right,
that's all.
Right, right. That's a little cover up.
Right. Yeah.
So what would you recommend?
I mean, I do think that if you feel like maybe building that relationship alone, I'm not sure that the other kid would have been willing to build a relationship. But if you thought that, I mean, I think at least to have it happening in your house where there's a little bit more.
The only thing is, the reality is that we're not moving, so they would be, he'd be going back to the same school, they'd be in the same middle school. So then the peer pressure kicks in, and he's
right,
more popular, and my son really in 6th grade was sort of, I'm
on the outs.
Nobody touched him, but he was on the outs.
Right. My only thought is that invitation was coming from the mom, not from her son.
Right.
And that was probably something that the mom was forcing, because, like you said, she wanted to sweep it under the carpet.
Yes.
I don't think that the son would have felt that, oh, we had a play date now. This is my punishment for having beaten him up.
Right.
And I don't think it necessarily would have resolved anything.
I can tell you something that just happened to my grandson. Started being bullied in a new, he's in a new school, but this happened recently, so he's been there since September. I don't know if my daughter and son-in-law reported it or he reported it. In 2 hours, the principal called them both in, together, told the bully, this is not acceptable ever, 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 and I expect you to shake his hand and do whatever you can to make him your friend. And I just, this was just a couple of weeks ago, and I just asked my daughter about this, and she said, they're actually becoming friends. She said, 11. And he's 11, but he's like a little on the scrawny short side. So he, not willingly, but he sort of wears a kick me sign sometimes a little bit. And I'm not, I don't think that gives anyone a good excuse to kick him. But I know, we all know that he could be in for it a little bit, and a little bit of a know-it-all, you know, because he's bright, whatever it is. But 2 hours, within 2 hours, it was done. And I thought that was phenomenal, because I don't think it's typical. You tell me. Okay, but even in private schools, I've never heard of any turnaround that fast.
But I do think that it sounds like the climate of that school is really good.
Yes.
And that the administration is really good. And I think that, I mean, I'm in two different schools, and I can see the difference when there's an administration that cares and when there's an administration that has oversight. And it changes the climate. When the climate is different, I think it changes the way the children view these types of negative interactions and how to turn them around.
Right, right. And I think what was good there was the bully got the message, this won't fly over here, but he also got some direction. And here's what you do instead. You shake his hand, you behave nicely to him, and you'll see, you two start to play a little bit together and see what happens. So he got balled out, and he also got a different direction to go in. So I really admire that principle.
But you know, the other thing is that the person in authority in your situation really took control of the situation.
Yes.
By calling you in.
Right.
Because I think that if the principal would have called both children in and really dealt with
and bypassed the parents. You can talk to fifth and sixth graders at least to start with. Mm-hmm. You know, yours almost got out of hand. It became so dramatic, and
well,
everybody has to meet.
Right. Everybody had to be at the meeting.
Right. So it's all, well, I mean, there was physical, there was actual violence. So is that standard procedure?
I mean, standard procedure, I would think, is that the child would get suspended, but then there would be a meeting when they come back to school with the child.
But there wasn't suspended. It was 20
years. Yeah, they've gotten much stricter about bullying and stuff. Okay, let's take a look at number 4, which is also pretty true to life. Somebody just told me this. So Alan realizes that his office mate, Robert, is sabotaging another employee, Jack. Now, if he reports it, it will be traced to him, and so he will ruin, well, he might jeopardize his own position, and he'll certainly ruin his working relationship with Robert. But he doesn't want Jack to suffer either. What does he do? What are his options? Is that clear?
Is there some way that he could report it where Robert wouldn't know?
No. In this circumstance, which was told to me, and because Alan would be the only possible one who could have spotted that sabotage, so it would definitely get back to him. You need a mediator. What does he tell the mediator?
I wouldn't.
You know?
I'm just thinking, if I was Alan and Robert's sabotaging Jack, I wouldn't put it against Robert to sabotage me after he sabotages Jack. So
that's
I would
true.
Report it.
You would report it.
What about confronting Robert?
Like that.
What about confronting Robert? I know what you're doing. This is my friend. You'll have to do something about it or else.
So You wouldn't.
I wouldn't trust anyone sabotaging.
You would figure somebody
else.
Who's sabotaging someone else,
thing?
He'll do the same to you, and you would say, just confront him.
I see what you're doing, and
cut it out.
Cut it out. And we'll have to.
But you know he could still turn against you and do something.
Right.
He could turn the whole thing. I mean, this goes to an ethical dilemma and a personal relationship dilemma. I kind of like this one.
Guys, what
can we say? Well, there are hotlines at some companies too. I mean, Hopkins has a confidential hotline.
So
there's an ethical,
a bigger company would have something like that.
Yeah.
But a small
company.
A company of 15, 20 employees, they're not having a hotline.
Sounds like a whistleblower. Isn't that a whistleblower?
Well, Alan would be the whistleblower.
Yeah, I guess. Not as big as Benghazi, but yeah. What do you think?
Are they all at the same level? Because I think if Robert is a boss, it makes the situation different and more complicated.
Sounds like they might be on the same level.
His office mate.
Yeah, I think they're on the same level.
How would confront Robert?
Confront them?
Without hitting them over
the head. Right.
Well, remember, we're mature. We're in control of our emotions.
I think just letting him know that.
How would you let him know in a way that he wouldn't end up turning against you?
I want to know his motives. So that's what you confront him to try to find out what his motive is.
Why? What's important about
his
motives?
Is because Jack is not doing the job. You know, he's dead wood in the company. And this is, it's difficult to fire people. This is one way that Robert's trying to just get data to show that Jack needs to have a negative review. Or is it?
Isn't that still sabotage, though? Is it up to us to decide if Robert has a good reason for harming Jack? I'm asking. I'm putting it out there. It's not simple.
It's really not simple. There are too many variables, unknowns.
See why I say to call the rabbi? No, it's really, I'll give you an example. My sister just told me, you know how New York, everybody double parks and they're supposed to leave a phone number. So a lady in Brooklyn blocked somebody's driveway. And the man was late for work, and he looked around, he couldn't find her, and there was no note, call me. So he decided he's going to try to get out of his driveway. So he drove the car very carefully, but he smashed her car. He did damage her car, and he went to work. She comes back, apologizes, I'm so sorry, I didn't realize it would take so long. What happened to my car? And she actually brings him to Beit Din, to a rabbinical court. And she wants him to pay for the damage. Which I think is a little bit of a chutzpah, right? But her point is, you didn't have to damage my car just because I was blocking your driveway. This is New York. You want to guess what the... No, he did not have to pay. They said he was not responsible. However, he then turned around and countersued her for the damage to his car, because his car that got damaged as he pulled out of the driveway trying to squeeze through. What do you think?
No.
You should have had a camera taking pictures.
They said no. The rabbi said no. You're not responsible to pay for the damage to her car, but she's not responsible to pay for the damage to your car. You made the decision to try to get out of your space. Mm-hmm. So there, you know, there's halacha involved in some of these things too. So there could be with Alan and Robert and Jack, there could be a halachic approach. And it's worth asking.
I think the other thing is sometimes it's the place where the confrontation takes place.
What do you mean?
Not in the office, someplace outside.
You mean if Alan chooses to confront Robert?
Not
in public and not in the office.
Right. Someplace neutral.
Okay. Okay. So you see that relationships can get complicated. And I'm hoping that, I know I learned, that there's a lot we can do to foster healthy, solid relationships. It could be anything from a smile to a kidney and anything in between. And, you know, we've all read about that. And I just want to point out that the last Mishnah in the Talmud says, Hashem did not find a vessel for blessing except for peace. The last blessing in Shemona Esrei, in the silent davening, is Sim Shalom, establish peace. The last blessing in Grace After Meals, in Birkat HaMazon, is Hashem will bless his people with peace. So there's nothing like Shalom. There's nothing like peace. It doesn't mean we have to lie down and be doormats, but we want to think really carefully before we're willing to destroy the peace. And there's so many stories of people who, especially in Israel, where, you know, somebody wanted to build a fence, a neighbor didn't want them to build the fence, and they were making all kinds of, family was making all kinds of plans, and the father walked in and said, no, it's not worth it for shalom bayis. We're not ruining our relationship with the neighbors. Yes, but we need the protection. Anyway, what happened was, the perfect apartment showed up for them just a couple weeks later. So you never lose by doing the right thing. That's, to me, that's the moral of all those stories. And peace is what holds everything together. And peace is what keeps us together. And the opposite of peace is war, conflict and war. And we don't want, I mean, some we will have conflict in our relationships. I don't always agree with myself, if you know what I mean. You know, I could be pulled two ways. So, of course, if we have a relationship with someone, there will be disagreements. But I mean active conflicts. We don't want that. The best thing is for us to have peace. So I peacefully wish you a wonderful Yontif. I want to thank Judy and her husband for sponsoring this. I want to thank Rachel Shalom for giving us this opportunity. And thank you so much. I've enjoyed spending the time with you, and hope you all have a wonderful Yom Tov. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.